I am Neo. Welcome into the Skeptic Arena. Today is January 4th, 2009. The website is theskepticarena.com. Today's subject, ancient astronauts. The term ancient astronauts designates the speculative notion that aliens are responsible for the most ancient civilizations on Earth. The most notorious proponent of this idea is Eric Von Däniken, author of several popular books on the subject. His Chariots of the Gods, Unsolved Mysteries of the Past, is a sweeping attack on the memories and abilities of ancient peoples. Von Däniken claims that the myths, arts, social organizations, etc. of ancient cultures were introduced by astronauts from another world. He questions not just the capacity for memory, but the capacity for culture and civilization itself in ancient peoples. Prehistoric humans did not develop their own arts and technologies, but rather were taught art and science by visitors from outer space. Where is the proof for Von Däniken's claims? Some of it was fraudulent. For example, he produced photographs of pottery that he claimed had been found in an archaeological dig. The pottery depicts flying saucers and was said to have been dated from biblical times. However, investigators from NOVA, the public television science program, found the potter who had made the allegedly ancient pots, and when they confronted Von Däniken with the evidence of his fraud, his reply was that his deception was justified because some people would only believe if they saw proof. The case of the ancient astronauts first aired March 8, 1978. However, most of Von Däniken's evidence is in the form of specious and fallacious arguments. His data consists mainly of archaeological sites and ancient myths. He begins with the ancient astronaut assumption and then forces all data to fit the idea. Well, that sounds just like creationism, doesn't it? For example, in Nazca, Peru, he explains giant animal drawings in the desert as an ancient alien airport. The likelihood that these drawings related to the natives' religion or science is not considered. He also frequently reverts to false dilemma reasoning of the following type. Either this data is to be explained by assuming these primitive idiots did this themselves, or we must accept the more plausible notion that they got help from extremely advanced peoples who must have come from other planets, where such technologies as anti-gravity devices had been invented. His devotion to his theory has not dwindled, despite contrary evidence, as is evidenced by still another book on the subject, Arrival of the Gods, Revealing the Alien Landing Sites at Nazca. There have been many critics of Von Däniken's notions, but Ronald's story stands out as the most thorough. Most critics of Von Däniken's theory point out that prehistoric peoples were not the helpless, incompetent, forgetful savages he makes them out to be. They must have at least been intelligent enough to understand the language and teachings of their celestial instructors, which would be no small feat. It is true that we still do not know how the ancients accomplished some of their more astounding physical and technological feats. We still wonder how the ancient Egyptians raised giant obelisks in the desert, and how Stone Age men and women moved huge cut stones and placed them in position in dolmens and passage graves. We are amazed by the giant carved heads on Easter Island, and wonder why they were done, who did them, and why they abandoned them in place. We may someday have the answers to our questions, but they are most likely to come from scientific investigation, not pseudoscientific speculation. For example, observing contemporary Stone Age peoples in Papua New Guinea, where huge stones are still found on top of tombs, has taught us how the ancients may have accomplished the same thing, with little more than ropes of organic material, wooden levers and shovels, a little ingenuity, and a good deal of human strength. Nova's Secrets of the Lost Empires made no appeal to alien teachers in the attempt to figure out how the ancient Egyptians might have raised a giant obelisk, how the medieval warriors built their catapults, and how and why the sculptors of Easter Island did what they did. We have no reason to believe our ancient ancestors' memories were so much worse than our own that they could not remember these alien visitations well enough to preserve an accurate account of them. There is little evidence to support the notion that ancient myths and religious stories are the distorted and imperfect recollection of ancient astronauts recorded by ancient priests. The evidence to the contrary, that prehistoric or primitive peoples were and are quite intelligent and resourceful, is overwhelming. Of course, it is possible that visitors from outer space did land on Earth a few thousand years ago and communicate with our ancestors. But it seems more likely that prehistoric peoples themselves were responsible for their own art, technology, and culture. Why concoct such an explanation as Von Däniken's? To do so may increase the mystery and romance of one's theory, but it also makes it less reasonable, especially when one's theory seems inconsistent with what we already know about the world. And why restrict one's examples to Egypt, Mexico, and other non-European countries? What about the builders of Newgrange or Stonehenge? The ancient astronaut hypothesis is unnecessary. Occam's razor should be applied and the hypothesis rejected. And now we go to the science segment, where today's subject is virgin birth. A black-tip shark at the Virginia Aquarium got pregnant despite not having been around a male of her kind for a decade. Scientists have long suspected that sharks, like some smaller vertebrates, could reproduce asexually, but this is only the second confirmed case. Tests showed the baby shark had genetic material purely from its mother. No one is sure what triggers asexual reproduction, known as parthenogenesis, in female sharks, but experts suggest it may be a shortage of males. It is unlikely to help dwindling shark populations, though, as the lack of genetic diversity is equivalent to the result of many generations of inbreeding. It's kind of a crapshoot, a last-ditch way to reproduce, said one of the researchers, whose findings appear in the Journal of Fish Biology. And now the arena goes abroad. Today, a story from December 1st, about a month ago, entitled Cemetery in Mumbai Won't Bury the Terrorists. A Muslim graveyard has refused to bury 9 gunmen who terrorized Mumbai over 3 days last week, leaving at least 172 people dead and wreaking havoc at some of its most famous landmarks. The shooters, whose bodies are unclaimed thus far, are not true followers of the Islamic faith, according to an influential Muslim trust that runs a 7.5-acre graveyard in downtown Mumbai. People who committed this heinous crime cannot be called Muslim, said a trustee. Islam does not permit this sort of barbaric crime. The gunmen's bodies now lie in a morgue awaiting last rites, while the lone surviving militant is in police custody. Normally, unclaimed bodies thought to be Muslims are given to the nearest Muslim graveyard for burial after 3 days. And today we have a special bonus feature on religion. And this came from several years ago. I don't know the exact date. It begins, saving one of his most audacious initiatives for the twilight of his papacy, John Paul II attempted to purify the soul of the Roman Catholic Church by making a sweeping apology for 2,000 years of violence, persecution, and blunders. From the altar of St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, he led Catholicism into uncharted territory by seeking forgiveness for sins committed against Jews, heretics, women, gypsies, and native peoples. Fighting through trembles and slurrings caused by Parkinson's disease, the Pope electrified ranks of cardinals and bishops by pleading for a future that would not repeat the mistakes. Never again, he said. Centuries of hate and rivalry could not recur in the third millennium. We forgive and we ask forgiveness. We are asking pardon for the divisions among Christians, for the use of violence that some have committed in the service of truth, and for attitudes of mistrust and hostility assumed towards followers of other religions. And he makes a plea for brotherhood. Defying warnings from some theologians that the unprecedented apology would undermine the church's authority, the 79-year-old pontiff asked God to forgive the persecution of the Jews. We are deeply saddened by the behavior of those who, in the course of history, have caused these children of yours to suffer. And asking your forgiveness, we wish to commit ourselves to genuine brotherhood. Wearing the purple vestments of Lenten mourning, the Pope sought pardon for 7 categories of sin: general sins, sins in the service of truth, sins against Christian unity, against the Jews, against respect for love, peace, and cultures, against the dignity of women and minorities, and against human rights. Ethnic groups had endured contempt for their cultures and religious traditions. Women were all too often humiliated and marginalized. Trust in wealth and power had obscured the church's responsibility to the poor and oppressed. There was no reference to homosexuals, who had asked to be included for suffering theocratic violence. The Pope did not identify guilty individuals or name the Crusades, the Inquisition, or the Holocaust, but the references were clear. 5 Vatican cardinals and 2 bishops confessed sins on behalf of the Church during the ceremony. Cardinal Edward Cassidy recalled the sufferings of the people of Israel, asked divine pardon for the sins committed by not a few Catholics against the people of the covenant. Several Jewish leaders praised the sermon as historic and significant, but Israel's chief rabbi said he was deeply frustrated by the Pope's failure to mention the Holocaust and described the service as a severely warped view of history. Rabbi Israel Meir Lau joined other Israelis in expressing hope that the Pope had omitted acknowledging the Church's passivity during the Holocaust only because he was planning a specific apology during next week's pilgrimage to the Holy Land. Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, head of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, confessed to the sins of the congregation's predecessor, the Inquisition. Even men of the Church, in the name of faith and morals, have sometimes used methods not in keeping with the gospel. Applause from the congregation greeted the Pope's arrival in the Basilica. He kneeled before the Pietà, Michelangelo's statue of the dead Christ, in the arms of his mother. Before being wheeled to the altar, he leaned on his silver staff, and it took several attempts for him to get out of his chair to kiss the crucifix. The Vatican no longer denies the Pope has Parkinson's disease. An operation to remove a tumor, several falls, and an assassination attempt have left him hunched and stiff. Seeking forgiveness, he has apologized for the Crusades, the massacre of the French Protestants, and the trial of Galileo and anti-Semitism. Yesterday's apology was by far the most sweeping and an unprecedented act for the leader of a major religion. One of the highlights of this year's Jubilee, or Holy Year, it was the result of 4 years' research by a panel of 28 theologians and scholars. Echoing widespread concern from liberal as well as conservative theologians, the Bishop of Como said, "In whose name exactly is the Holy Father asking pardon? He is relying on a group of experts, but tomorrow another group of experts might come up with a different example." Other churchmen said the gesture would be seen by Muslims as a sign of weakness and by secular enemies as a cue to launch further attacks. The Pope's persistence in ramming through the initiative, despite resistance inside the Vatican, has doused claims that he has effectively retired and abandoned policymaking. The document that provides the theological framework emphasizes a distinction between the sins committed by the Church's sons and daughters and the Church itself, which remains holy and immaculate. Speaking after the ceremony to the crowd in St. Peter's Square, the Pope stressed he was seeking forgiveness not from those who had been wronged, but from God. Only He can do that. Now he discusses 2,000 years of violence and persecution. First, the Crusades. Pope Urban II, anxious to assert Rome's authority in the East, sent a military expedition in 1095 to reconquer the Holy Land. The Crusades ravaged the countries they passed through and massacred the Muslim, Jewish, and even Christian population of Jerusalem after capturing it in 1099. After 200 years of conflict, Muslim armies drove them out for good, but the Crusaders' symbol of the Red Cross remains provocative. Next, the Inquisition. The attempt to combat suspected apostates, Jews and Muslims at the time of the Reformation, spawned tribunals in Europe and the New World that tortured and executed thousands. Ecclesiastical queasiness about flowing blood led to the use of racks, thumb screws, and red-hot metal instead of blades. 2,000 people were burned at the stake during the tenure of Spain's first Grand Inquisitor, Tomás de Torquemada. And finally, the Holocaust. Pope Pius XII never publicly condemned the Nazis' persecution of Jews, even when they were being rounded up and deported from Rome. His silence is partly blamed for the failure of Germany's Catholics to resist Hitler. Anti-Jewish Catholic doctrines, such as the claim that the Jews murdered Christ, were said to have ideologically underpinned Nazism. Vatican officials allegedly helped Nazis escape Europe after the war. And now for the final segment of the show, as always, famous quotes. Today, George Bernard Shaw, born 1856, died 1950 at the age of 93. He was an Irish playwright. Although Shaw's first profitable writing was music and literary criticism, his talent was for drama, and he authored more than 60 plays. Nearly all of his writings deal sternly with prevailing social problems, but have a vein of comedy to make their stark themes more palatable. Shaw examined education, marriage, religion, government, healthcare, and class privilege, and found them all defective. Well, I've got bad news for him. Nothing's changed. He was most angered by the exploitation of the working class, and most of his writings censure that abuse. An ardent socialist, Shaw wrote many brochures and speeches for the Fabian Society. He became an accomplished orator in the furtherance of its causes, which included gaining equal political rights for men and women, alleviating abuses of the working class, rescinding private ownership of productive land, and promoting healthful lifestyles. Shaw married Charlotte Payne Townsend, a fellow Fabian. They settled in St. Lawrence in a house now called Shaw's Corner. Shaw died there from chronic problems exacerbated by injuries he incurred by falling. He is the only person to have been awarded both the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1925 and an Oscar, 1938. These were for his contributions to literature and for his work on the film Pygmalion. Shaw wanted to refuse his Nobel Prize outright because he had no desire for public honors, but accepted it at his wife's behest. She considered it a tribute to Ireland. He did reject the monetary award, requesting it be used to finance translation of Swedish books into English. And now I have two quotes from George Bernard Shaw. First, "The fact that a believer is happier than a skeptic is no more to the point than the fact that a drunken man is happier than a sober one." Quote number two, "What is wrong with priests and popes is that instead of being apostles and saints, they are nothing but empirics who say, 'I know,' instead of 'I am learning,' and pray for credulity and inertia, as wise men pray for skepticism and activity."
Are you ready, Goose? Start walking.